2016, at that time, they had a feature article. In the Ball Kingdoms in 1914, Millennial Donner's 25-year prophecy. And it goes on to observe that the Bible students for 25 years have been predicting that a war of major proportions would begin in 1914. So there's copies here if anybody wants them. And here's just a historic note. A New York Times issue back in August on World War I breaking out. Okay, we're going to be dealing with divisions that started taking place, and again, to make the division significant enough, and not just academic, I will name names of groups and perhaps at times names of individuals objectively, just, you know, identifying what particular group they might have been involved in at the time. After the judge came out with the seventh volume, the judge had the viewpoint that the Jordan was going to be smitten shortly. And the outbreak of World War I, he was convinced that this was the time of trouble and things were going to wind up pretty quickly. So he felt the seventh volume was a very strong message. I have material on here, but I'm not going to take time to deal with it because there's... we won't get through with this all day long. Anyway, the reprint articles, when I say reprint articles, the judge's reprint articles between 1917 and 1918 that you have access to, they had the old green reprints. They said the harvest was ended, the door was shut, and they were smiting the Jordan. And because of that, the word public work had just been pretty much closed down by the government. And as you know, Judge Rutherford and the board of directors of the Watchtower were indicted. There was a 1917 Espionage Act that was hyper-patriotic, and they could indict you on almost any statement you made that was seeming against the government, even if it was a religious statement. So, the clergy were just incensed at the seventh volume. I'll just show one picture here if I can grab it. Here's the body, of course, you know, Brother Russell started the Bible Study Monthly. It was a tract that came out every month. And here the judge continued it, and he has one on the fall of Babylon, and has a car, you know, the illustration here, the fall of Babylon, and has all the non-church ministers on those Babylon's collapsing, this big building representing Babylon. They're hanging on to the different rocks that are floating into the water. One is Romanism, popes, cardinals, and etc., Protestantism, creeds, clergy, doctrine of the Trinity, 3 × 1 = 1, eternal torment theory, and the clergy were just incensed. And there was a conspiracy. Pardon? Yeah. There was a conspiracy. And they got O'Brien, who was in the judicial branch of government, to pressure, lobby Congress to pass this Espionage Act. And it was geared, as far as the clergy were concerned, to get the Bible students. And this is documented. And the judge and the board of directors were indicted on the basis of this 1917 Espionage Act. And the judge, I won't say being a good lawyer, but the judge being a lawyer, what do? You destroy the evidence. So what was the basis of the indictment? Quotations from the seventh volume. So the judge came out with a revised edition of the seventh volume, and he deleted all of the objectionable parts that the government was indicting them on. Well, what's all this got to do with the divisions in the Bible Study Movement? Well, the first division in the Bible Study Movement took place after the death of Billy Russell, and that was the Standfast Movement. And you say, "My, that must have been a wonderful movement. They were standing fast." But what were they standing fast for? They were standing fast for the first edition of the seventh volume. And they believed that the Jordan should be smitten, and we should be giving a harsh message. And they agreed with the seventh volume that the door would be shut in 1925. So that was your first break off. And that has some sad ramifications. I won't go into it, but there's the Suki movement, and they lived in a cooperative arrangement on an island off the British Columbia, and the leaders of that movement convinced all of the members of the movement there in Suki that they weren't spirit begotten. And there was some very sad, the history of the Standfast Movement was a very sad one. It was based on the concept that the little flock is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Everybody else is a great company, so because it was getting smaller, they continually split off to be of the smaller group. But then, with the judge's high-handedness and the claim that the seventh volume, even the modified seventh volume, was the posthumous works of Billy Russell. By the way, that illustration says Pastor Russell's seventh volume. Because they build it as the posthumous works of Pastor Russell.
Which means that he wrote it before he died.
In other words, there's a lot of quotes. I would say 70% of it is quotes from Billy Russell, but then the commentary in between is what makes it objectionable. So, as a result of the judge's high-handedness, a group of brethren, the first split was the Standfast, but then a group of brethren came out in 1918. And they came out together, but they went three ways. Paul Thompson and Streeter and some of the Hollisters and Isaac Hoskins formed the PBI, the Pastoral Bible Institute. And P.S.L. Johnson, who came out with them, he says, "I can't join that. That's another organization. No, we just left an organization. I'm not going to join another organization." So he started his own organization. And that was the Layman's Home Missionary Group. And they, of course, felt the door was shut in 1914. But then there's a third segment, and I call them the original independent brethren, but there is no organic connection between them and the independent brethren. And we are a part of the beginning of the 1970s. But this original independent movement, trying to think of the leader of it. This was Brother McComb. He was in Pittsburgh, and then Brother Cox in Boston, and the Jersey City class, Brother Fry and the Jersey City class were all part of this original independent movement. And they believed that there would be no more organizations that the Lord would use.
Yes, Brother Hirsch.
Brother Hirsch went with P.S.L. Johnson, but he broke with P.S.L. Johnson in either 1921 or 1922, and he joined up with this independent movement in 1921 and 1922. And they believe that the last organization the Lord used was the Watchtower, as long as our wife and faithful servant was alive. When he died, the Lord would use no more organization. So they would have nothing to do with any organization. And the only thing they printed was the actual writings of Brother Russell. They would publish his tracts, or they would publish his sermons, or publish his articles, but they would not reprint anything, write anything on their own. Of course, the inconsistency was that when they gave discourses, they gave their own discourses. But for the most part, they were very sound on, you know, these doctrines of the grants and restitution, well, covenant presence, chronology. But every movement has its shortcomings, and over a period of time, many of them concluded that there was no need for public work. Many of them concluded the door was shut. I used to serve on a convention program in Jersey City with Brother Cox, Brother Snow, who some of you knew, Sister Cox and Sister Snow of later years, and Brother Jim Woody and Brother Fry, and there was a private convention between the Boston Cox class and the Jersey City class, but when Cox started preaching his door closed theory from the platform, as opposed as Brother Fry was to concerted public witnessing, he certainly felt the door was open, so that broke that. Now, this will explain, and I'm not going into Sister Vicky's viewpoint at all. I don't know what she does or doesn't believe, but this will explain a lot of Sister Vicky's strong doctrinal position, you know, that you brethren agree with. Somehow or other, she and her husband got involved with this East Coast movement. It was basically an East Coast movement. And when I first met these brethren out east, and they found out that I was raised in Detroit, they right away asked, "Do what was Sister Vicky's husband's name?" Anyway, you know, she had asked those. We knew them, and Virginia did. They weren't in the Polish class. How are you doing? They would visit the Polish brethren, you know, in their homes, but they would not attend their meetings because the Polish class had their own organization. No, the Polish movement had its organization, so they would have nothing to do with them. When the Dawn started up, these brethren would have nothing to do with the Dawn because it was our organization.
They were against the public. This group was generally not for public work.
They evolved. I say the majority of them evolved to this.
Okay.
Now you have the black class in Brooklyn, who in the beginning, Brother Graves or Reeves, however they pronounce them both ways, and Brother Brissette. Ray Luke was raised in this class. Now, Brother Graves always believed in public wickedness. In this class, Ray talks about attracting Harlem. Going down these narrow, dark hallways in the tenement houses in Harlem, and he attracted it. Now, they're putting on public meetings, so I know some of them did believe in it, but I would say the majority of them by the 1950s, early 1950s, when I became involved with them, or in contact with them, were pretty much against the public work. So, then just a brief rundown of the PBI. The PBI in the first board of directors meeting, or the first general membership meeting, I guess, they came out very strongly for the presence, and that they would, you know, if they were in harmony with the teachings of Brother Russell. But by 1924, and of course the PBI published the Herald of Christ's Kingdom, by 1924 they rejected the 606 BC date. And after that, they began to lose sight of many of them. Most of them began to lose sight of the reign and the times of restitution and jubilees and et cetera, along that line. And some of them went to the point that they even, by the 1930s, they many of the PBI brothers in New York, or Brooklyn, started meeting. Once a month, they would get together with the New Covenant brothers. So then many of the PBI brothers, not the PBI officially as a movement, but many of the PBI brothers took on some of the New Covenant brothers, these forms of churches under the New Covenant, no sharing the sin offering, the Lord isn't present. So the PBI had became very tolerant doctrinally. It really didn't make much difference what you believed. And they had members on the board of directors who didn't believe in the presence. I asked T.S.L. Reed, when he was general secretary of the PBI, he and I were very friendly. And I said, Brother Reed, if you had a pilgrim who didn't believe in the presence, when you found that out, would you take him off the road? And T.L. said, no, he said, we wouldn't take him off the road. He says, unless he started making an issue that the Lord wasn't present. He says, and for that matter, he says, if we had a brother on the road who believed in the Lord's presence, and he made an issue of the Lord being present, we'd take him off the road too. So in other words, doctrine just wasn't important. That has its ramifications to this day, and I won't get into that unless anybody raises a question. I gave the PBI movement how they developed, and the independent movement how they developed, and of course the Johnson movement were all against the closed door. I mean, against the door being open. They felt it was closed in 1914. Most brethren who believed the door was closed believe it was 1918. Okay, are there any questions on what we set up at this point?
We'll make a little comment just going along with what you said about the PBI today. Brother Mark Chastain had put out that he would be willing to help any group of Bible students put out a web page. One of the requirements was that the door was open. Another one was that the Lord was present. And the PBI apparently approached him about helping with the web page. So he said, would you print in your publication, you believe the Lord is present? And they wouldn't agree to that condition. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Actually, some of the brethren have, gotten involved with the brethren we know have been gotten involved with the PBI, and they were offered it on the silver platter to take over the editorial work of it, because the brother who was the executive secretary just taken it downhill so far that there was even a reaction among some of the more liberal brethren, and so some of the brethren that we know were invited to take over the editorial. And they had hoped to turn it around to the first meeting concept, that the belief in the presence and other doctrines. And there was one brother that was on the board of directors yet that was still didn't believe in the presence. And he was going to retire shortly, so they thought that problem would be solved. But lo and behold, in the last year, the membership elected another brother who was younger from the New Covenant movement to the board of directors, and he doesn't believe in the presence. And I've been told, and now this is hearsay, to take it as that, I've been told that he actually believes when the Lord returns. And these brethren now believe that the Lord is going to return in the flesh. This is a different concept among no presence brethren now. They used to believe that they felt it was still an invisible presence, but it would be in the future. But now the brethren who in the New Covenant movement who are preaching the no presence concept, they believe the Lord is going to return in the flesh. And this brother believes he's going to burn up the earth.
Oh,
wow. I guess it's the Advent concept that, you cleanse the earth by burning earth's surface. Now, I've been told this. I definitely know he doesn't believe in the presence. think the other is, for what it's worth, is here.
You know, the new program we're looking at today is really very similar at all to the one that split off.
It's a direct lineage, but of course, there's changes. The one big change they have made, and this is why Gilbert Rice is not involved with the New Covenant movement in the United States. He's involved with the New Covenant movement in Australia. There are two reasons. One is the New Covenant movement in the United States doesn't believe in the presence. The New Covenant movement in Australia believes in the presence, only they changed the date to 1799. The Lord returns 1799. But the other reason that Gilbert and some of the brethren are turned off by the New Covenant movement in the United States is they don't preach. Although Gilbert doesn't believe in the Church of Sharon and Sin Offering, he believes in sacrifice. He believes in consecration. And the New Covenant movement, to try to keep their youth, are actually just presenting the concept of consecration to righteousness. And the Lord doesn't expect you to give up the things of this life. So that's a... how they have strayed from the original concept of the New Covenant movement. The New Covenant brethren were had high consecration ideals, but that is not the case now.
So Gilbert Rice believes that
Christ returns. Yeah. Okay, are there any other questions up to this point?
How does Iaconi fit in?
Iaconi is a part of the New Covenant movement. The Iaconi boys, brothers, played a big part in it in their younger years. One thing about the New Covenant movement, they encourage their young people to go on to college and to excel, develop as high as you can, and they became very highly acclaimed and known in the academic world. They have published a number of books. So, although they're in the movement, they are not active in its leadership as they used to be. Okay, would you like to end this at this point, or do you want to bring it all the way up to our day? Or do you want to end it and go and then it was suggested that we go into a study on Israel? Or do you want to continue this for maybe about another half hour?
I'd like to bring it up to our day. You know, I've spent all day on it, but I would like to get to the other ones. I'd like to hear all about our day because this is all very new to me.
Ruth?
Are you writing a book on this? Just because this is absolutely nowhere else to get something.
I might put it on tape sometime. I don't think I'll write all this detail in the book. I will. No, I'm working on the book on the Bible sort of movement refutes the charges of the nominal church. No, I think that this is interesting. Unfortunately, a lot of this detail you won't have in the book. Although you might. I don't know how much of it and how objective it will be. Rolando is supposed to deal with what happened in this new book that this group of brethren are getting out. He's supposed to deal with what happened since Brother Russell's death, but I think he's going to go into not so much the direction I went, but the splinter movements from the watchtower after Brother Russell's death up to our day. Maybe not, I don't know. Okay, you want to go on with this? And no, I I don't like speechifying like this. Break in any time if you want to say something. I hate to conduct a meeting like you observed.
You're discussing last night.
Well, you're not in place. You're not in place.
If you were here all the time, it wouldn't be this.
As long as you don't tell us we're out of order, bro.
Prophet's not about honor, except in his own soul.
Brother Rick suggested that I deal one of the topics I deal with because he thought it would be of interest to many of the brethren here. Are you interested?
This is yours, Rick. Rick.
Okay, yes. Okay. The next big event in the truth movement as we know it and as it affects us is 1928. Of course, in the meantime, as far as the Watchtower was concerned, they just went off the deep end. They threw all character development. They became very immoral. Very shortly, by 1919-1920, the leaders of the movement at conventions, you see them at the restaurants, they were drinking ale or wine, or right in the open, you know, that's no problem. And, okay, 1928, Brother George Wilson, who was Ernest of the Frank and Ernest program, led 80 brethren out of the Watchtower class in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And they said, well, where are we going to go? You know, we're all by ourselves. What are we going to do? So the elders of this new form class had a meeting. They said, well, we know brethren have been leaving on a small, well, we know a big group left in 1918. And on a small scale, some have trickled out over the years. Brother Russell, the anniversary of Brother, this was in August, 1928, the anniversary of Brother Russell's death was the end of October. They said, let's have a reunion convention at the end of October, and let's invite everybody we know, we have names and addresses of who left the Watchtower from 1918 onward, left the society from 1918 onward. So they had the convention. I don't know what the attendance was, but it was a big success. I was there, but I was 2 years old.
That wasn't Chicago.
No. Pittsburgh. It was in Pittsburgh. And so they had a business meeting. They said, would you like to continue this? You know, have it annually, and the brethren voted for it. Well, by 1929 and 1930, they began to realize, well, this is an odd mix here. Well, we're inviting brothers to speak, you know, who were prominent in Brother Russell's day, and they left, and who were they? They were PBI brethren. And they weren't the independent brethren that, you know, I spoke of, that broke away, you know, in 1918 and went the third way from the PBI and the layman. But there were a few independent groups that weren't in that grouping, and they, like Brother Sephora, you know, Ruth, you know, Brother Sephora, Sister Sephora. So, and then it was these brethren that came out after 1928. More of them kept coming out, and if they were for no comment in the Watchtower day, they invited the speakers. But they saw this odd mix. Some were against public work. Some, you know, didn't care to discuss the presence. And some had just come out of the society, they were gung-ho about the presence, and they were gung-ho about public work. So, about 1931, the burning issue of the convention, it was the burning issue of the business meeting, and I don't know if you've seen these convention reports of these reunion conventions, the Pittsburgh reunion conventions. I have a few of them, but the 1931 one, the illustration they had in it describing the burning question of the business meeting, it was a lamp, a
great big bushel over the lamp, and here this little figure trying to push this bushel off the lamp. Now the question was, should we let our light shine? And Brother Woodruff came out of the society in 1930, and he joined the only class that was available. And that, and when I'm talking about Brother Woodruff, no, I'm not talking about Clayton Woodruff, I'm talking about Norman Woodruff, who was the general manager of the Dawn for many, many years, and one of the founders of the Dawn. He joined up with the only class in Brooklyn, and that happened to be a PBI class. And he proposed to the PBI, to the class, he was elected an elder, and he proposed to the class the Frank and Ernest program. Because unknown to most brethren, Frank and Ernest started it in the society. Dan and I had a few laughs last night on the way back from the airport. I was telling Dan about the type of programs they had in Frank and Ernest in those days. It was a riot. Got any time during casual fellowship time you wanted to discuss it, it's really make you laugh. But anyway, Brother Woodruff proposed to the Brooklyn class that they have Frank and Ernest programs. And they agreed. And they carried on this work. This began in 1931, 1932. Well, by this time, public witnessing was a burning issue. It was, you know, they had at this general convention in Pittsburgh, a business meeting. Well, the Brooklyn class got sick and tired of the business meetings they had to have about conducting the business of this radio work. So they said, well, form a radio committee and you conduct this business. We don't want this to come up and, we want to have studies. We want to have meetings. We don't want to have business meetings every Sunday. So they formed the radio committee. But the radio committee had to keep coming back every time they had to wanted to make a new expenditure. They needed money. So it was still tying up the Brooklyn class. So the Brooklyn elders said to the radio committee and Brother Woodruff, you go to the PBI and present a proposition to them to handle the radio work. So they went to the PBI, had a meeting with the board of directors, and the executive secretary of the PBI at that time was Isaac Hoskins, who was quite solid in the truth. Quite an exception to most of the PBI leadership, but dead set against public witnessing. And if it would have been even Paul Thompson, who became executive director later on, especially P.L. Reed, if it would have been him, there would never have been a PBI and a Don. They would have been all one. But the PBI turned down flat the offer to go into public work. They said, our ministry is a pastoral work to the brethren. So the radio committee formed the Don Bible Students Association. And that's how the Don Bible Students Association began in 1922. And the radio work went on for a year or two, then because of the Depression and all, it just dropped out of sight. But that was the starting of the Don. And especially between 1928 and 1935, there was a continual exodus, large exodus from the Watchtower. And they were joining the only classes that were available that were actually the old PBI classes. But now these old PBI classes were having their ranks swelled by brethren who were exiting from the Watchtower. And these brethren were gung-ho about public witnessing. And they were gung-ho about the Lord being present. So it started to cause problems in the class. The classes. And we mentioned last night, Rick brought up Oscar Magnuson, and he set the tone in the Dawn movement. The directors came to the conclusion because of his, he said, you know, why should we compromise anymore? We stand at this point doctrinally, and we're not going to budge from it. And that was the concept that the Lord is present, the church has a share in the sin offering, and the new covenant is future, and the church is developed under the Sarah featured the Abrahamic covenant, the door is open. Later on, they spelled out the resurrection of the sleeping saints as being important, but they dropped that a while back. So, the Dawn organization took a strong stand, and their speakers started going around the country, talking on doctrine. And the TBI speakers and the Dawn speakers would serve at the same convention platform, and there was a continued debate going on. So, between about 1938 and about 1942, and on later in the 40s, there were splits all over the country. And it was down organizational lines, yes, whether you supported the PBI or whether you supported the Dawn, but the PBI, brothers, stood for the liberal tolerance of along the lines of doctrine, and the Dawn brother, and public witnessing isn't that important, and the Dawn brother standing for presence and offering and covenants being important, and the public witnessing is important. So the Dawn element, actually, was the majority element in most of the classes, a few exceptions, one of them, most of the classes. Okay, walk, that is a balance between taking a strong stand for the truth, but a loving stand for the truth, and at the same time holding our hands out in love for brethren and other groups to try to help them to see the truth, and do all of this in a way that we are not compromising the concepts we believe in. So I'll end with that note.
Wait a minute. Did you purposely avoiding going into why you brought this chart three volumes?
Well,
you
mentioned that they did.
Oh, no, I didn't purposely avoid it. I mean, I'll answer it if you...
Like what? I know that there was a whole chain of events that went into why you started publishing volumes, but just like going into publishing, not very many known.
Okay, the reason that some brethren wanted, they wanted to set a volume without the Dawn name in it. That was in New Brunswick's reason for doing it. I presented the concept in New Brunswick. You know, I ran the presses at the Dawn, and I printed the Dawn volumes, and boy, I watched those sheets come out of the press, and that type was so battered and old and worn, I was ashamed of it. And my proposition to New Brunswick was, let's publish a set of volumes that will be used to great advantage in the public work and the harvest work. There were three things involved with this set of volumes that would make it appealing for the harvest work. One, new type. Good binding. And we accomplished that as one brother, especially in the Crown edition of the volume. Well, one young brother came over from Poland. We gave him a set of volumes. He says, you look at these volumes. He says, just invite you to open them up and read them. Mm-hmm. To him, that's how it feels. Well, that's what we wanted to accomplish. That was one point. The second point was you start reading even the first volume. You give somebody a first volume, brand new first volume, start reading. Obviously, this was written way, way long ago, back in the 1800s. What are you giving me a book written in the 1800s for? So we take the seeming weakness of the book and have an enthusiastic publisher's foreword where we show that these books are classics because they stood the test of time. And this is the selling point of these books. Sure, they were published, they're old books. But they stood the test of time, and they're still in demand. So the third point was, well, you, although Brother Russell had a few footnotes on the 1914 date, he didn't have many, so we were, every place 19, where it said in the volume that everything would end by 1915 or 1914, or Israel would be, a nation, or the church would be glorified, that we would have a footnote that merely appointed the reader to a 1916 forward that explained Brother Russell's clarification on 1914 and 1915 without interpreting the matter. And we have, I think, about three or four footnotes that just give historic references to verify points that, you know, a date that Brother Russell, like, for instance, the 539 date. There's a date that's it's hard to really pin down in a history book. So we give Gibbons, and you have to go to a footnote in Gibbons, you know, to prove the 539 date at the beginning of the 1260 years. So there's about three or four footnotes in that category. But the other footnotes is strictly whenever 1914 or 15 mentioned something that happened, was going to happen, that didn't happen, we just refer them to 1916 forward. So we felt these three factors would make the volume very effective in public witnessing. And brethren, it has. And the way your class uses the volume, the way other classes use the volume in public witnessing, it's fantastic. It just makes me cry. And that's what the volumes are intended for. And that's the way they're being used.
Do you want to comment on the